Okay. Welcome to the Kimball Northeast Asian Humanities Lecture Series. My name is Shoko Hamano. I am the chair of the Department of East Asian Languages and Literatures. Today's talk is co-sponsored by the National Resource Center and the Department of East Asian Languages and Literatures. The Kimball Northeast Asian Humanities Lecture Series was established with a generous gift by Professor Emeritus Yang-Yi Kim Renaud and her husband, Dr. Renaud. The lecture series aims to bring specialists in East Asian humanities and cultures to GW in order to encourage cross-disciplinary discussions. In fact, through today's talk by Professor James Marshy, we are venturing deeper in the direction of cross-disciplinary understanding of East Asia. Professor Marshy is a professor and department chair at the George Washington University here. He directs the Cochlear Implant Communication Lab, where his currently funded research explores the development of speech perception and production abilities by children with cochlear implants. So without further ado, here is Professor James Marshy. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Shoko. I'm really excited to be able to talk a bit both about what my department is about and the things that we do in training speech-language pathologists, and more broadly, what speech pathology is like in the United States. But more central, I think, to the mission of this department, at East Asian Languages and Literatures, is the idea of what's happening in China. And how is this profession viewed? How is it developing? And where does it yet have to go in order to be what I believe it wants to be and can be in China? So thank you, Shoko, for inviting me. Thank you to the Segor Center for also co-sponsoring this. I'm looking forward to the next 45 minutes or an hour. And then we'll have an opportunity for questions at the end. But if you have any questions while I'm speaking, please feel free. This is an intimate group on a Friday afternoon, so we can have a conversation if questions arise. Let's see if this works. Yes. So my interest in China really began about 1996 in my first trip to China. But more recently, my interest has been sparked by a few things. First of all, is the university's global initiative, in which it is clearly a part of our strategic plan. My professional organization, the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, also has as a cornerstone of its strategic plan global engagement. And then my department has really embraced this, and so we have had a series of student trips and collaborations with universities in Korea, South Korea, in Mexico, Nepal, and soon, in May, we will have a group of students that will be going to China. So all of this sort of converged my interest, and as well as it matching what I think are some of the important strategic aims of various entities that I'm involved with. So this afternoon, what I would like to do is start out by talking a bit about the profession of speech-language pathology, describe a little bit about what speech pathologists do, SLPs, we'll abbreviate it, okay, SLPs, speech-language pathology, SLPs do, and something about the work setting, job prospects, things like that, so that you'll be kind of better versed in what SLP is like here. The second half of the talk will focus more on China and what are some of the, what's happening in China with respect to speech-language pathology. So, how many of you have encountered a speech-language pathologist, maybe in your personal life? I see a few of our majors here, so. And have you, as a personal interaction or with a child, perhaps? Okay. That was my first encounter when I was eight. And I went to a speech pathologist in school for my S production. And that was pretty typical back in the time that I was in school. Now, S productions are not really covered in school. You probably wouldn't get therapy in schools for that. But for more significant speech language issues. So I scrolled a series of tasks that a speech pathologist might be involved with at the beginning of this. That kind of captures the day-to-day activity, but it may not capture what exactly speech pathology is about. Anybody want to venture? I think there are a couple of people here who might have an idea. I don't want to pick on you, but what do speech pathologists do? Yeah.
Speech pathologists is about to conduct with the speech disability students and to have somebody will have some problems with the voice production, with the pronunciation problem or swallowing problem. All of this can be done and fixed it in the speech therapist.
Right. So, I mean, all of those are areas that speech pathologists may be involved with. The primary goal of a speech pathologist and the special training they receive. Yes, did you have? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll put that.
Okay.
I know that they treat and implement services and intervention for individuals with some sort of communication disorder,
yeah.
Whether it be voice or speech or language.
Right, exactly. So they treat, and before they treat, they have to assess, and that is a skill set in and of itself. What do you evaluate in order to get a picture of what are the strengths and weaknesses? And then important in this day and age is diagnosis. It's important because a child getting services in the school won't get any place without a diagnosis. The individual who's getting Medicare or insurance payments will get no place without an appropriate diagnosis. So the speech language pathologist is involved with assessment, diagnosis, treatment, and actually prevention as well. So we've already talked a bit about what they do. You mentioned voice, articulation, and resonance. Resonance would be if an individual had a cleft palate, that would impact on their ability to produce sounds and to have a natural voice quality. Fluency, stuttering, that obviously is a significant communication disorder. Social communication, and by that we mean the pragmatics of language. And this is obviously a very important diagnostic indicator in children with autism, but it also impacts on individuals with traumatic brain injury and other disorders. You mentioned swallowing. This is something you don't really think about as the domain of a speech-language pathologist, but it is. My dad had a stroke a few years ago, and I visited him in the hospital, and before he would be cleared to eat solid foods, the speech language pathologist had to sign off, and they had to do an assessment before that, in fact, would happen. So the speech language pathologist in those kinds of settings is very key to the feeding and swallowing issues, as well as feeding in children. Next Tuesday, a little plug, at 1 o'clock, we will have a guest speaker who will be coming from the University of North Carolina to talk about feeding with infants and young children, some of the disorders. Accent, I don't like this term, but it's a term that's used in speech, language, and hearing science. Accent reduction, it's really for people whose second language is English and who are in situations where communication effectiveness is important, to try to, in some way, reduce the effect of L1 on L2 to increase intelligibility. And then finally, literacy, reading and writing. That's a shared responsibility. Sometimes it's somewhat contentious about whose domain it is, but speech language pathologists are very much involved with literacy. So I mentioned assess, diagnose, treat, and prevent are some of those activities. The populations are across the board. So speech language pathologists may be involved in the NICU with feeding or with infants and toddlers as they begin to develop spoken language, school-aged children, high school kids, adults, and older adults, geriatric individuals with just the aging process, could be cognitive issues, could be other things that come with aging. Settings. We're going to come back to this in a little bit, but most speech language pathologists in the US, as you can see, 53% are in schools. A small number, 3% of us, are in university settings. We have the speech language, speech and hearing center. It's over at 21st and G in the lower level of the government hall. But that's a fairly small percentage. Assisted hospitals account for about 13%. Residential healthcare facilities, nursing homes and the like, about 10%. About 16% are in non-residential healthcare facilities, and about 5% in other settings. This is a little deceptive because a lot of people do more than one thing. So some people, for example, that are in private practice may only do that part-time, and then the rest of the time they may be in a school, they may be in a hospital setting. So there are about 19% of speech language pathologists, or 1 in 5, is involved with a private practice. In addition, they may or may not be involved with other activities. So these are, you know, keep in mind these are not firm numbers, but clearly the majority of speech language pathologists are working in schools. I call this the history of a profession in one slide. So I may have a lot of detail here, but I don't mean to do that. I just want to kind of give you a flavor for how this profession developed, because we may be able to draw some parallels to what's happening in China now. So the earliest practitioners, even in we could go back to Grecian times, I suppose, to talk about putting stones in the mouth to improve articulation. But we'll kind of stick with North America, and we'll talk about the earliest practitioners in the late 19th century, early part of the 20th century. And the individuals that, many of the people that made up this group were individuals who developed approaches to addressing certain kinds of communication disorders, largely because they had them themselves. So a lot of the early workers or early speech correctionists were people who stuttered themselves, who had voice problems themselves. So I'm going to have to look at my notes because I don't have these names exactly memorized. But Nathaniel Bogue, he started the Stuttering Institute in Indianapolis. He himself was a stutter. Robert Bates, he developed the device to help increase fluency. He also was a stutterer. And Edgar Werner, who developed an approach to dealing with stuttering, he also was a stutterer. How many of you have heard of Alexander Graham Bell? Yes. What'd he do? Yeah, he was a telephone guy, right? But you may not know that he was also very involved with promoting spoken language in deaf children. In fact, he and Thomas Gallaudet, who founded Gallaudet University across town, were involved in a series of debates and battles over the appropriate way of addressing communication in children who were deaf and hard of hearing. But he certainly was instrumental in developing spoken language in deaf children back in the late 1900s. His interest, he was married to a deaf woman. In the early part of the 20th century, that's where things started to pull together, and there actually were a group of people who felt that there needed to be a scientific basis to the profession. We needed to have an understanding of what it is that we're doing and how effective it is in addressing the problems we're trying to deal with. So there was a group of about 24 or 25 speech correctionists, and they formed the American Speech Correctionist Association, ASCA. And these are some of the earliest names that, I hate to say this, but Lee Travis was one of these individuals. And when I was starting in graduate school, there was a handbook that was edited by Lee Travis. So I'm not that old. It wasn't that long ago, but there certainly have been a lot that has happened since about 1925. 1945, the end of World War II, marked a significant increase in the provision of services, largely because soldiers came home from the war and they had aphasias, they had traumatic brain injury, they had other kinds of wounds and injuries that affected their ability to communicate. So there was a big push to kind of systematize how we were delivering services. About 1965 or so, and those of you that are linguists, you may, this is about the time of Chomsky coming on the scene, and there really was an appreciation for the idea. Up to this point, it was primarily input-output. You know, what's speech like? Is it okay? Are there things we can do to correct speech? About this time, the notion that speech is really the expression of language, and we really need to be as concerned about language as we are about that output. And so this marked the beginning of the linguistic era, and you know, things like transformational grammars and generative phonologies all started to be manifest and represented in what we did. About 1975, we discovered pragmatics. And in this sense, we were more interested now in sort of the context in which communication was taking place. So not just the content or semantics and the form, syntax and phonology, but also the use. I'm hard-pressed. I think we benefit from looking back on what we're about, and we can't quite look back at where we are now, but certainly, if I were to characterize the contemporary trends, I think a lot of work in speech-language pathology is really aimed at trying to understand the neural substrates and the cognitive factors that contribute to language use, and how addressing some of these cognitive factors may, in fact, help language performance. So that's our profession in one slide. Covers about 120 years or so. So what does it take to become a speech-language pathologist? Okay, well, it's a master's level entry. So in order to enter the profession as a speech-language pathologist, you would have to get an undergraduate degree plus a master's degree. Most master's degrees are 2 years. Sometimes they're a little bit more, sometimes a little less. But at the undergraduate level, you need a grounding in science and math. And that's what this stuff is about. So all of our students have to come in with this. We don't provide this at the master's level. All of our undergrads are guided to take these courses, because in order to get certified as a speech-language pathologist, you have to demonstrate you have these things. In addition, at the undergraduate level, you have to have some specialized courses that deal with speech and hearing. And the first six are the standard six. These are courses that, if you had these, you would likely be eligible to most of the 300 or so master's level programs in the United States. The final two are requirements for our program, because we have a very heavy concentration of neural disorders, and we feel that for people who who are preparing to become speech pathologists, it helps to know a little bit about what the clinical practice is like. What do you do as a speech language pathologist? Some of you are taking that now, I think. I don't expect you to focus on this, but this is our curriculum. Yes?
I have a question. I'm very curious why pathologists would require sciences, like math, or,
Well, the math requirement is actually statistics.
Okay.
That has been narrowed to, it has to be in statistics.
Okay.
The production of sound and the nature of sound is physics. Much of what we do as clinicians borrows from psychology, so, and behavioral analysis. So I think it's the foundational things. They may not directly impact on what we do, but senses that they're essential for being able to be competent and comfortable in the things that you have to do as a professional. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm not going to defend
still,
it, but
still
these
require statistics as a basic requirement.
Undergrads have to have a statistics course. They don't have it when they come to our program. They have to take one. And I'll talk a little bit later about certification and accreditation and licensure. But to get certified, you have to have those courses that were on the first page, plus the courses that were on the second slide about education. And then you would also have to demonstrate that the certification requirements are less prescriptive at this level. So we have to make sure that we capture and cover a range of knowledge and skills dealing with articulation, language, voice, swallowing, a number of areas, and these cover it. Our program is 42 credits. Many programs out there are like 55 to 60, but ours is 42, but it's a very packed 42. And again, I think some of our students out there will agree that it is a packed 42. It's 2 years in a summer, it's five semesters. Two academic semesters, fall, spring, then a summer, and then a fall and spring. Central to the clinical experience, to the education is a clinical experience. And there are actually many clinical experiences. In our clinic, students may typically get 100 to 125 hours of practicum experience. They're going to get experience across a range of areas. I think we have 8 different areas, and all of our students rotate through those. So it could be adult neurological disorders, pediatric language disorders, voice, speech sound production issues, literacy, accent modification. What did I forget? Oh, fluency and AR, yes, yes. And did I forget any others?
Social communication.
So this is in-house. So this is over the course of the first 3 semesters. Then second year, our students go to 2 different clinical settings, usually in the metropolitan area, but that's a growing circle. And many of our students opt during the final semester to identify a site that may be distant from here. So we've had students in New York, we've had students in Philadelphia, Chicago, I think in Virginia, in Maryland, but further out. So the idea is that you need to get different kinds of experience to get a flavor for and to be able to generalize your skills. Seems like a lot, doesn't it? So there is a lot of education involved in becoming a speech language pathologist. And wait, it's not over. So once you do graduate, then you qualify, if you graduate from an accredited university or program, ours is, you have to, in order to get this national certification from the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, you also have to complete a subsequent clinical fellowship year and you have to pass a national exam.